It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. You probably racked up at least a few regrets in your life. They might be small things, like wishing you left earlier when you're running late for something. Or they could be bigger things, like wishing you had the courage to ask someone out or that you chose a different career. Our next guest says those regrets are a core part of what makes us human. He says if we understand regret better, we can actually use it to our advantage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, if you're willing to share, do you have a regret that's been hard for you to let go of? Or have you been able to take a regret and learn from it for the next time? Have you learned things from your regrets over time? How have they changed the way you act now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Pink is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you lay this out right off the bat in your book. A lot of people love the concept of no regrets. Some of us even get it tattooed on ourselves. Why does this no regret idea become so widespread?
Well, I think it's because we're a little bit over-indexed on positivity. We think that we need to be positive all the time. We think that we should be looking forward all the time, that we should never look back, that when we experience a negative emotion, particularly a negative emotion like regret, we should brush it off, think positive, and move on. And the trouble with that philosophy, that no regrets philosophy, is that it runs against 50 years of science, and it's a terrible blueprint for living.
Why? Why is that a terrible blueprint for living?
Well, because regrets serve a function. Here's the thing. Regret is one of our most ubiquitous emotions. It is one of the most common emotions human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion human beings have. There's 50 years of evidence showing that the only people who truly don't have regrets, right, who actually are true to this no regrets philosophy are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed enough, people with certain kinds of brain lesions and neurodegenerative disorders, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And, you know, I don't like experiencing regret. Nobody does. So there's this puzzle about why is something so unpleasant, so widespread? And the reason is it's useful if we treat it right. And the problem is we haven't been taught how to treat it right. We think of it as something to ignore. When we can't ignore our regrets, we end up wallowing them. What we should be doing is confronting our regrets, thinking about them, using them as engines of progress.
All right. How do we do that? I look back at some of my life I regret. A, I probably don't want to think about it. As you say, B, if I start thinking about it, I wallow in it. How do I steer that better course?
We have a lot of evidence on how to do that more effectively. It begins with how we think about ourselves and our regret. When we talk to ourselves in the face of missteps and screw-ups, we are brutal. Our self-talk is vicious and cruel, and the solution to that is stop doing that. Instead, practice something called self-compassion. Self-compassion is treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, recognizing that your regrets are part of the human condition. You're actually not that special. If you have a regret about kindness or lack of boldness, it's very, very common. And also our mistakes are a moment in time, not the full measure of our life. And so once we treat ourselves with self-compassion, we can begin to talk about our regret, make sense of our regret, and systematically extract a lesson from it that we can apply next time.
Talking to Daniel Pink about his new book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you regret and that you're willing to share? Do you feel like you wallow in it? Do you try to forget about it? Or have you learned from it? Do you have questions for our guest about this, the science of regret? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, you've done these massive surveys, first in the United States, then a worldwide one looking at regret. What are some of the most common big regrets that people express in these surveys?
Well, what I found and actually look at, so thank you for mentioning that. So I did one big giant public opinion poll of the U.S. population that showed that when you look at sort of the main areas of people's lives, people regret a lot of different kinds of stuff. They have regrets about careers. They have regrets about education. They have regrets about health. But then I also did something called the World Regret Survey, where I just collected regrets, a lot. We now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. And what I found there, when you actually go beyond the domains of life, and I read through the first 15,000 of these, is that around the world, over and over again, people seem to share the same four regrets. Over and over again, they express the same four regrets. They have less to do with the part of life you're in, career, education, whatever, and more to do with, I think, some fundamental human longings and aspirations.
What are those main longings and aspirations that that will lead us into this path of regret?
Well, I'll go through them very quickly. Foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who have regrets about saving too little, spending too much, about not taking care of their health, about not working hard enough in school. Again, small decisions early that add up to calamitous consequences later. Second category, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. Again, this spans the domains of life. You mentioned one at the top of the show, Rob. Well, a lot of people regret not asking somebody out on a date. But these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret not starting a business, people who regret not speaking up. They're at a moment in their life when they can play it safe or take the chance. They don't take the chance, not always, but often they regret it. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. These are regrets about bullying, marital infidelity, other kinds of transgressions. And finally, the fourth category, connection regrets. If only I'd reached out. They're relationships, it's regrets about relationships that have come apart or should have been intact or were intact and are no longer intact. And somebody wants to reach out, but they say it's going to be awkward. The other side's not going to care. And so they don't do it and it drifts apart further. And with remarkable regularity, people express these same four regrets.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
I have a question. What can we do, or what are some mechanisms when we find ourselves loathing, maybe in some of these regretful type thoughts? Any help for our viewers or listeners, rather? Thanks.
Sure. Sure, Jake. So as I was mentioning earlier, one of the best things you can do is to stop. The first thing is to stop that march toward rumination. And the way to do that is to treat yourself with the same generosity and kindness and empathy you would treat somebody else. If a friend of you came to you and said, "Oh, Jake, I made this mistake," you typically wouldn't say, "You idiot, what's wrong with you? You're the worst person in the world." But that's how we talk to ourselves. And as I said before, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness. Recognize that these mistakes, these regrets are part of the human condition. The second thing you can do, and it's really important, is to talk about it or write about the regret. When we talk about a regret or write about it, we unburden ourselves. What's more, we do something profoundly important for negative emotions. We take this abstraction, this blobby negative feeling, convert it to words, and then that's far less fearsome. These concrete words are less fearsome than the abstract emotion. And finally, we have to draw a lesson from it. We have to be explicitly draw a lesson from it. And a good way to do that is to get some remove from it and ask yourself, what would I tell my best friend to do in this situation? Or what would I want to have done 10 years from now? And so when we reframe inward and treat ourselves with kindness, when we express outward and make sense of it, and then when we move forward by drawing a lesson from it, we can begin to develop a habit of using our regrets as an engine for progress. And when we do that, there is a massive amount of evidence that it helps us in profoundly important ways. I mean, even in more reductively narrow ways, it helps us become better negotiators. It helps us become better problem solvers. It helps us become better parents. The problem is no one has taught us how to do that. And it's a very simple process.
Thanks for that question, Jake. We're talking to author Daniel Pink. His new book is called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to live your life with no regrets? How is that working for you? Or have you made a point of learning from regrets, things that you see as mistakes in your past and trying to get it better the next time around? Or do you have questions about how all this regret stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with author Daniel Pink about his latest book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You could join in to share regrets you've had, how you've overcome them or dealt with them, or your questions about regret. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel on Facebook writes, "We cannot change the past, but we can certainly learn from it. Holding on to regrets or resentments destroys our ability to enjoy today." What do you think? Share your thoughts. Dan, something that struck me in your book, you share a lot of regrets that people shared in your surveys. One story that really stuck with me when it comes to Joel's comment about learning from our regrets, a woman who talked about regretting that she hadn't listened to her grandparents more, enjoyed time spent with them until it was too late, they'd passed away. She took that, though, and said, okay, as my parents age, I'm going to make sure to listen, and I'm going to make sure to take that time. Can you talk about that as an example of how we can use our regret?
Sure. It's a great story. This is a woman named Abby who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she was growing up, her grandparents, who lived in Indiana, would come and visit for a couple of months a year to, you know, because Arizona winters are far more pleasant than Indiana winters. And when she was a kid, she hated it. She resented them being there. And then they passed away and she realized she had screwed up. And what she missed was the connection, the stories. And what she decided to do is, again, this is a great example. She could ignore it, say, no regrets, no regrets. Look positive, be positive, look forward, right? Or she could say, oh my God, I'm a horrible human being. This is the worst thing that anybody's ever done. Instead, she said, oh, I feel bad. That negative feeling is a signal. It's a signal about what I value and it's a signal about what I should do next. And so she has begun systematically collecting the stories of her parents, who I think are in their early 70s at this point, making an effort to collect their stories and assemble their stories. And so she has that sense of meaning, she has that sense of purpose. And it's a good example of the best way to deal with regrets, which is to use them as information, as data, as signals.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Adams. Randy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Randy?
Well, I just think another word for regret is forgiveness. You have to learn to forgive yourself. Because most people that have regrets, it's because it's their something that they have done and that they should have done. And if they learn to forgive themselves, they can work towards, like, say you said something bad to a friend or something and you regret it, and then it just eats at you and eats at you. You got to forgive yourself for saying it, and then maybe you can go to your friend and apologize.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dan, what do you think about the forgiveness part of this?
No, I think Randy makes a great point. I mean, what she is calling forgiveness is an aspect of self-compassion, which is, you know, treat yourself as generously as you would treat somebody else. You know, the other thing that that Randy mentions is a pretty interesting distinction in the architecture of regret, which is regrets of action and regrets of inaction. Regrets about something that I did and regrets about something that I didn't do. So for things like, let's say you said something terrible to your friend, to use Randy's example, that's a regret of action. You can actually sometimes make repairs on those. You can apologize. You can make amends. You can make restitution. What's interesting is that what lives with people far longer than regrets of action are regrets of inaction. As we age, regrets of inaction, regrets about what we didn't do, outnumber regrets of action by about 2-1.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Pink about his book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan, a thing that really strikes me here is a lot of the regrets, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of, we become science fiction authors and craft the alternate history. What if I had gone to school or hadn't gone to school or married this person instead of that person or whatever, and our alternate history is way better than the one we're really living. What? How do we get over that one?
Well, it's an interesting question, because sometimes our alternate history is way better than the one we're living in now. But I think what really eats at people is not knowing what that alternate history was, and also not delivering at the moment. So, for instance, I have a lot of people who regret not asking, as we talked earlier, not asking somebody out on a date or something like that. But very few of them say, oh, if I had asked him out on a date, we would be married and have three kids and, you know, living, you know, a beautiful life in Milwaukee. They're not saying that. What's gnawing at them is, in that particular case, is not stepping up at the moment of being at a juncture in their lives and having a chance to do something bold and shrinking from that chance. Now, you're right that the way we think about regret is to conjure these alternative histories. But what seems to bug people about a lot of these inaction regrets is not so much the outcome, but the decision itself.
Now, one thing about your four main buckets of regret, the foundation one, where I wish I'd taken better care of myself, planned for my financial future, and so on, it seems sometimes to contrast with the boldness one. I wish I'd taken that chance. I wish I'd done this thing on the spur of the moment. How do we reconcile those two? I wish I'd taken more risks versus I wish I'd hedged my bets better.
Yeah, that's a good question. The things that people did, I actually think there's actually a very close affinity between having a stable foundation and having a psychologically rich life. I think that having a stable foundation allows you to take sensible choices. The foundation regrets that people were talking about were not, you know, they were spending money on frivolities. They weren't saying, oh, I tried to start a business and it failed, and therefore I'm in bad financial shape. I don't think I had anybody who said that. I had people who said, I earned an okay income, but I spent it going out to restaurants and buying cars and stuff that I didn't need. The foundation regrets were very rarely a trade-off with boldness. They were something different. They were about kind of investments in oneself. It's not like people were being overly risky in compromising their foundation. They were being actually stupid in many cases. And when you have at least a stable foundation, that gives you a little bit more of the temerity to take that trip, to try something more adventurous.
We heard from Dean on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, regrets equal fear of the past, worry equals fear of the future. Live in the now, Dean concludes. Easier said than done for me, Dan. I don't know. Is that normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not terrible advice, but I think that one of the things that you see in some of the research on the temporal side of human development and human flourishing is that what we want is in some ways an integration of the past, present, and future. What we want is we want the past to inform our present, and we want the present to guide our future. There is a very interesting personality psychologist at Northwestern University in fairly nearby Evanston, Illinois, and he says that people see their lives in terms of narratives, and there are two kinds of narratives. That he says, Dan McAdams is the guy's name. He says there are contamination narratives where things go from good to bad, and there are redemption narratives where things go from bad to good. And humans seem to flourish when they see their lives as redemption narratives. And the only downside, the downside of living in the present only, is that it's not a narrative. It is simply, you know, processing this particular moment and not seeing how it integrates into one's past, present, and future. And we know healthy flourishing depends, at least in part, on seeing your life in this narrative terms of making progress, of getting better, of moving from bad to good.
Dan, you talk at the end of your book about, this isn't just research you've done for research's sake. It has started to seep into your life. How has your long look at regret changed your own personal behavior?
Well, on these connection regrets, I have to say it's changed it significantly. So what happens with these connection regrets is that people have these relationships, often friendships, usually not, I'm not talking about romantic relationships mostly. Let's think about a friendship. And the friendship comes apart. And usually they come apart in profoundly undramatic ways. They drift apart. And one side wants to reach out and they say, nope, it's going to be awkward if I reach out and the other side's not going to care. So it drifts apart more and it feels more awkward and they think the other side's not going to care less. And they're wrong. There's a pile of evidence showing that reaching out is far less awkward than you think. And the other side almost always welcomes it. And so for me, it's like if I'm at a juncture where I'm saying, should I reach out or should I not reach out? Being at that juncture has answered my question. I mean, always, you know, reach out. If you're at that juncture, reach out. And that's changed me because I'm not somebody who is like super social or super, you know, really good at reaching out. But this changed my view on it because I had those misguided views of awkwardness and the suspicion that the other side wouldn't care. And I was flatly wrong.
Well, now, apart from reaching out, Dan, in our last minute or so, leave us with a bit of advice on how to start using regret in a happier way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would suggest with people is this. This week, have a conversation with someone about your regret. People want to talk about this. Tell somebody around the dinner table, in your office, hey, I have here's a regret that I have. Here's what I've learned from it. And here's what I'm going to do about it going forward. That simple process. Here's my regret. Here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do about it. That will trigger one of the richer conversations that you will have this year. I can almost guarantee it. It's a topic people want to talk about. It's a topic that we've made taboo, but it's a topic that can yield very powerful lessons in what we value and how we should lead a meaningful life.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Pink, author of several books. We talked to him earlier this year about his latest, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll mark Father's Day and Juneteenth with the author of a new memoir looking at her dad's wisdom and his life in the Jim Crow South. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Dinner doesn't have to have a big entree. Build a great meal around the little things with the author of the new cookbook, Snacks for Dinner. Small bites, full plates, can't lose. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection resumed its public hearings today. We'll look at what they covered and get reaction from a Wisconsin political scientist. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to the creator of the FBI's active shooter program and get her thoughts on the police response to the recent mass shooting in a Texas school and how law enforcement should respond to active shooters. Now, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its third public hearing today. Today's hearing focused on former Vice President Mike Pence, his responsibilities and limitations under the 12th Amendment, and pressure from former President Trump on Pence to unlawfully overturn the results of the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching or listening to the hearing today? What do you think? What questions do you have about what came out? What do you hope we still find out? Are there things that you think should be done when it comes to accountability for people involved in that, changes to laws in the future? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today, Ron.
Before we get to today's hearing, Lily, could you highlight some of what you took away from the first two hearings leading up to this?
Well, again, the committee is kind of trying to lay out a sort of clear understanding not only of what transpired in the assault on the Capitol on January 6th, but also what led there in terms of, you know, how the people who came there were inspired to come there, what the plan may have been, who was involved in any planning, and also, you know, sort of discussions and understandings of what was going on in the Oval Office, in the White House, in conversation about, you know, what the election outcome was, how the president had been, you know, alerted and it had been explained to the president, and, you know, what his then sort of response to the presentation of those facts has been.
The focus today, again, on Vice President Pence and pressure from President Trump in particular to try to get him to claim unilaterally this power to ignore the electoral slates from different states. Lily, a lot of the drama, of course, was the violence, the assault in the Capitol. Supposing that hadn't happened and the crowd had stayed peaceful that day, how shocking would it be, though, to see a president trying to have a vice president claim this non-existent power and ignore the results of an election?
I think that would have remained quite shocking. I mean, I think it was made even more so by, obviously, the assault on the Capitol, the fact that, and if those who are watching the hearings today or listening to some of the testimony, we saw footage again of Vice President Pence and many of his staff and his family being escorted out of his office that's off the side of the Senate chamber. And so you have all of those things that did transpire under this umbrella of violence and attack, and people also advocating for hanging the vice president or killing the vice president. And even if none of that had happened, the advocacy to a vice president that he or she has the capacity to essentially invalidate the votes of any number of citizens in a variety of states because the president doesn't like the outcome is shocking.
I want to give a listen to one of the live witnesses today, former federal judge Michael Luttig, a conservative lawyer, a mentor to a lot of prominent figures in the conservative legal world and others. Here he is, and I think it's a quote that people will turn back to over time.
That declaration of Donald Trump as the next president would have plunged America into what I believe would have been tantamount to a revolution within a constitutional crisis.
Can you respond to that and the other testimony from former Judge Michael Luttig?
What he is talking about is, you know, again, if the vice president had followed through on what he was being pressured to do, and there were two tracks that he was being advised he could take, he could either essentially suspend the counting of the Electoral College votes on January 6th and send the Electoral College votes back to the states to be reanalyzed, I guess, not the votes themselves, the Electoral College votes, but the votes in the states themselves and thus the slates of electors. That was one option. And the other one was to essentially invalidate the slates of electors, say that they were not valid electors. And both of those would be, as my reading of the Constitution, the 12th Amendment, the Electoral Count Act of 1887, and sort of longstanding norms and traditions in the United States, both of those would be extremely unconstitutional options. And so what Judge Luttig was talking about was if the vice president had followed that path, then you would have had not only a constitutional crisis because the constitutional structure would have been essentially undermined by this move, which isn't allowed in the Constitution, and you would have had significant violence in the street, likely, because there would be a response from the people who had voted against Donald Trump or voted for Joe Biden with regard to essentially trying to remove then the illegitimately sitting president. I think that's what Judge Luttig was talking about.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at today's hearing of the January 6th Select Committee, focusing on pressure on Vice President Pence to block electoral slates from a number of states, likely including Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a number of opinions on this topic. First of all, I don't think it was an insurrection because we have three branches of government and the riot was only attacking the legislative branch. The second point I want to make is Trump was president until January 20th. So on January 6th, he had a responsibility as the leader of the executive branch to make sure that the election was appropriate and fair. And there is fraud in the 2020 election. I think history will prove that because the Dominion voting machines have not been inspected and the algorithm.
Jeff, thanks for calling in. Lily, the previous bits of testimony really tackled this. Then Attorney General Bill Barr and so many others day by day refuting arguments about claims of fraud.
Yeah, I mean, and that's essentially where you end up on January 6th is that the investigation, and I think the Trump campaign brought 60 or 62 different lawsuits with regard to this, and that the Electoral College voters voted in December, and those votes were certified by the state legislatures in those states, and then they were then communicated to the United States Congress, where according to the 12th Amendment, there is a joint session that is presided over by the vice president in his role as president of the Senate, and they're opened and counted.
And the concern was raised at the end, Lily, by Judge Luttig and some of the people on the panel that this isn't about 2 years ago. There are still claims, as we just heard, about Dominion voting machines that some officials in New Mexico were saying, well, we can't certify an election because Dominion voting machines. These are still live issues that Judge Luttig was concerned could lead to a concerted effort, maybe a successful concerted effort to overturn an election in, say, 2024.
Yeah, and that was his. Those were his concluding remarks, and that he's also written those up with regard to the possibility that in a future election for president, if the outcome is one that doesn't comport with, say, Donald Trump, should he be running, and his supporters and allies, and these are Judge Luttig's words, that there would be a move in the states to overturn it. Through a lot of the different machinations that are possible with regard to different certifications of electoral college voting slates.
We're talking to Carroll University Professor of Political Science Lily Gorin, looking at today's public hearing by the House Select Committee investigating the insurrection on January 6th, 2021. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to what you're hearing? The evidence today, looking at the pressure on Vice President Pence to claim a power to stop electoral votes from being counted from a number of states. Do you think laws need to be changed? Do you worry about future elections? What do you want to see come out of all of this, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Lily Gorin from Carroll University. The House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its latest public hearing today, looking at pressure from then-President Trump on then-Vice President Pence to overturn the 2020 election by either refusing to count some electoral votes or send it back to states. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Grafton. Bob, hi.
Hi, Professor, I may be mispronouncing this, but what do we do in the kind of world we're in now where so many people have cognitive dissonance, I'm probably mispronouncing that, where they believe basically, which isn't true, but they've convinced themselves that it's true. How do we handle that situation?
Bob, thanks for the call. Cognitive dissonance, I think Bob was referring to. But Bob, I think talking about claims of misinformation and claims about voter fraud.
Yeah. And again, I think this is one of the key sort of jobs of the committee and these hearings in particular is to set out the actual facts of what transpired. When you see the images of Mike Pence being escorted out of the Capitol with his family and all of his aides, and you hear from his counsel, as we did today, what it was like that the, you know, that they escaped the mob by 40 feet, essentially, and that the mob was coming to hang him. That, you know, sort of the reality of what was going on in this assault on the Capitol is sort of made a lot more clear. And as some people have suggested, it wasn't just some tourists visiting in a, as sort of an aggressive way, shall we say.
Thanks for that call, Bob. We'll go to Anne now in La Crosse. Anne, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for your guest. Just looking at what this, what the hearings and the Senate committee that is running the hearings, I realize that they're trying to, you know, get out as much of the truth as possible. I'm curious what your opinion is on what the results, what they're looking for in terms of the purpose and results of these hearings. Specifically, do you think that this will result in, or are they looking to press criminal charges against former President Trump?
And thanks for the call. And that's a big question. The committee itself can't do criminal charges. But Lily, what do you think the possible outcomes could be here?
Well, I mean, I think this was actually, today's hearings were a little bit, as we would say, in the weeds, more so than the previous hearings. And you got into a very interesting kind of legal dispute between the two witnesses over sentences in the 12th Amendment. And part of that has to do with how the Electoral College actually works and functions. And since it's in the Constitution and hasn't been removed, we still need to follow it. And so I think a lot of what the committee is also doing is sort of setting out areas that need legislative fixes. And one of those areas probably is the Electoral Count Act of 1887, when it was initially passed. And it may need some revisions to clarify some of the processes that follow along from the 12th Amendment and Article 2 in terms of the process of electing the president and the vice president. So I think that's part of what the committee is doing, is trying to sort of say, this is actually, we need to write legislative reform in some of these areas to protect against something like this happening again. They're also, you know, sort of making public a lot of the information and the thousands of interviews and hours of depositions that they've done. And that now, and the Justice Department has been following along in its own way, you know, with regard to potentially civil or criminal charges against a variety of people. And I believe in the midst of the testimony today, the Justice Department has asked the committee to send over all of its interviews. So the Justice Department has its interviews. The committee, as you noted, Rob, can't bring criminal charges against the people. They can make recommendations or referrals if they want to. This has been sort of one of the points of some dispute, whether they will do that. And the Justice Department would be the place where you would see criminal charges or civil charges brought against individuals.
Thanks for that call, Anne, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University about today's public hearing of the January 6th committee, in the U.S. House. Back to your calls now. Ed is with us in Madison. Ed, hi.
Hi there. You know, I really don't have a question. I have more of a comment, and I know it can probably be, it's like a broken record, but for people to come forward and you have this firm belief that the election was fraudulent, and you keep throwing the Dominion card of the reason why, that this was a good reason to, and it was an insurrection, not just on one part of the our political process. As a person from the outside looking in Washington, I like to see what I'm hearing, but I don't know if this is going to move the the dial closer to people maybe changing their mind? Or how do you feel that this is actually maybe going to be in the big picture? I know there's so much coming out, and it's really opened my eyes wide open, not just seeing what was on television, which was shocking enough, but when you actually get to hear it to this moment and then people have forgotten about it, it just is shocking, and I'm dumbfounded that people still keep fighting that narrative that our election process was fraudulent. Yes, I'm sure there could have been a small percentage of fraud because maybe someone tried to vote twice. Maybe someone tried to, you know, maybe registered in different states. We see it with our political governorship here in Wisconsin. Does someone actually live in Wisconsin, but they're trying to run for governor?
Ed, I got you. You gave us a lot to talk about there. Lily, do you think it's an interesting question? Apart from the legal aspects here, does the presentation of what happened leading up to January 6th and on the day, does it, as Ed wonders, change people's minds?
Well, I think that's part of what the committee is doing or trying to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why they had the first hearings during prime time on most of the major television networks, so that they actually have been constructing a narrative understanding of not only what happened on January 6th, but the process that led up to it. And that it wasn't sort of a spontaneous eruption of a couple bad apples. And so what you saw in the conversations today, in the discussions with the witnesses today, was that there was this sort of ongoing press on the vice president to essentially act in an unconstitutional manner. And when he didn't decide to do that, there was then a sort of advocacy that he wasn't a good person, he wasn't doing the right thing, and that, you know, that was problematic and maybe people should do something about that. And so you had this sort of long explanation of this legal theory presented by John Eastman with regard to the power that the vice president had, which nobody else thinks that the vice president really has, to essentially negate the Electoral College votes as they are counting them.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Courtney, pointing out the role of former Vice President Pence and his resistance to this pressure, his refusal to get in a car for fear that Secret Service agents would remove him from the Capitol. Can you talk a little bit about the pressure he was under and the role he played?
Well, he was asked quite a few times by President Trump and by John Eastman to sort of execute this plan. And as I said earlier, there were sort of two ways that he was told he could execute this plan. And he consulted with a number of people, including Greg Jacob, who was testifying today, who was one of his counsels, with regard to the sort of legality, the constitutionality of all of these things. And he decided, essentially, he came to the conclusion that it was unconstitutional for him to do that. He consulted with former Vice President Dan Quayle. He consulted with Judge Luttig. He consulted with quite a few people. And he kept getting pressure from the White House. It called from President Trump on the day of January 6th, even, to do this. And he didn't do it. And again, you see the mob, the pictures of the mob and the articulation of what some of the people who were at the Capitol who said, you know, we're coming for Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence, because he had, in fact, not done what the president had asked him to do, which was unconstitutional to do.
Lily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Lily Gorin is professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University. We talked to her about the hearing of the bipartisan House committee this afternoon investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and the events leading up to it. Coming up after the news, the creator of the FBI's Active Shooter Response Program talks to us about the recent school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and how to improve police training for similar incidents and how to hopefully prevent them from happening in the first place. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.